Good morning. Isn't it nice to have the sunshine out? It just does wonders for us in Wisconsin. We have some students that may be joining us later. It doesn't appear that they're here, the Lakeshore Technical College. So if they come later, we just continue as we do. But if you hear some commotion behind you when you're doing your presentations, that's probably what it will be, and our marshal will take care of all of that. So with that in mind, I will call our first case of the morning, State versus Wilson. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
Yes.
Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Lamb, and I represent Mr. Wilson. There are three reasons this court should remand for an evidentiary hearing to take testimony from Ms. Brown. First, in this case, the witness, Ms. Brown, clearly received notice of the hearing but did not come to the hearing. Second, at the time of the hearing, the state did not take a position on the continuance. In fact, the state requested that the court issue a body attachment. Third, contrary to the court's finding, Wisconsin law allows a subpoena to be left at a witness's home, which is what the investigator did in this case. Wisconsin statute 972.11, which is in the chapter titled Criminal Trials, provides that chapter 885 shall apply in all criminal proceedings. Turning to chapter 885 and looking at specifically statute 88503, any subpoena may be served by a person by, one, exhibiting and reading it to the witness, two, giving a witness the copy thereof, or three, by leaving such copy at the witness's home. Here, pursuant to 885, the subpoena was left at Ms. Brown's home. Therefore, in light of these facts, this court should find that the circuit court erred and remand this case for an evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, is due process at issue in this case?
Due process was not specifically raised in the briefs.
So it's just a statutory issue before?
Yes, that is correct. There was also an ineffective assistance of counsel,
right,
which does involve the constitutional right to counsel.
Well, do we look at this case through the lens of ineffective assistance of counsel? That affects the burden of proof and who has it?
So first of all, I do not believe that ineffective assistance of counsel necessarily needs to be reached.
Okay.
That was raised as an alternative argument if this court would determine either waiver or forfeiture. I believe that this court could simply find that the court erred here based on the finding that the subpoena was not properly served by leaving it at the witness's home. If ineffective assistance of counsel is reached, that does require Mr. Wilson to establish, first, that trial counsel was deficient, and second, that he was, in fact, prejudiced. The state argues that service was improper because Wisconsin Statute 805.07 requires that a party exercise reasonable diligence.
Counsel, before you get into an analysis of that statute, I want to make sure that I have an understanding of the flow of authority in the statutory sections. Could you start with telling me what 972.11 might say about the applicability of 805.07?
Yes. So 972.11, just paraphrasing, specifically says that Chapter 885 applies. And then in terms of, it also says that the civil rules of evidence and procedure apply unless the section or context manifestly requires a different construction. And so there's an additional requirement when you're talking about whether or not other civil rules and procedure applies. That requirement does not apply to Chapter 885. And so that supports why it was proper in this case.
All right, but let's, so 805.07 is that part of civil procedure?
Yes.
Okay, so 972.11 would say that's applicable unless the unless its context manifestly requires a different construction, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Does 805.07, is that context requiring a manifestly different construction?
I believe that it does because it adds on additional requirements before you can leave a subpoena at a witness's home.
So why would that mean that that's not applicable to criminal prosecutions?
Well, the statutes conflict. So they both require different procedures or standards or requirements in regards to the service of a subpoena. And so for that reason, they're at odds. So for under the 805, you'd have to first exercise reasonable diligence before you could serve the subpoena substitute. Whereas when you look at 885, it just provides three ways. That's it. Very simple. Exhibiting and reading it to the witness, giving the witness a copy thereof, or by leaving a copy at the witness's abode. It doesn't require reasonable diligence. And so those statutes conflict. And so I would, in this particular case, the 885 should apply. It's specifically in 972, which is a criminal statute, specifically directs your attention to that chapter.
Isn't it possible to harmonize the two such that 805.07, with its reference to 801.11, would simply be describing the manner in which service would be effective by leaving it at someone's abode?
I disagree with that because when you look at the 805.07, there you can't just leave it at somebody's abode. It has to be left with a family member. It has to be left with a person who's a competent adult who's residing. And so there's these additional requirements, whereas if you look at just the 885, it's simply you can leave it at the abode. There aren't any additional requirements. And so I have a hard time seeing how exactly, or it's unclear to me then, if you're applying the 805, how then or when does the 885 actually work? How does that play into it? Because it looks to me at least that the 805 has these additional requirements when you're talking about leaving it at somebody's home or at a witness's abode.
Leaving it at the abode, is that substituted service or not?
I believe that would fall under the definition of what substitute service is when you're looking specifically at the 805. So
where does it define substituted service?
I don't recall that was specifically in the statutes. I know the state had provided in their brief a definition of what it meant to serve substitute.
Because when I looked at 801.11(1)(b), B says if you can't serve the defendant under paragraph A, and this is personal jurisdiction, it's not subpoena. If you can't find him under A, which is personally serving within or without the state, you can leave a copy at the defendant's usual abode under B. And then 1 talks about leaving it at the abode if there's a competent member, 1M in the presence of a competent adult. And then 2 says, this is where I got confused, 2 says, pursuant to the law for the substituted service of summons or like process. Which made me think that substituted service wasn't 1 and 1M.
That is possible. I had not, that had not occurred to me before, but I certainly see your point in that respect. Either way, it just seems when you look at the 801 and the 805 that those do not apply to a criminal case. And so when you're talking about...
Well, they would if 972.11 is applicable to it.
As long as there wouldn't be a more specific statute, which would be the 885 in this particular case.
And why is that more specific?
That's more specific because, so when you look at 972, it's specifically or expressly states that 885 shall apply. So it's right. 972, it's a criminal statute, and it's directing your attention to Chapter 885. And so I would, so that is why that would apply. And
I thought it was more specific because it deals with a subpoena, not just generally. And deals with a subpoena on a witness.
Yes, and
it specifically says you can leave it at the witness's abode.
Yes. And when you look at just the context of the 805 and the 801, those are clearly very civil statutes, civil trial statutes, civil procedure statutes.
Why would it matter that they are clearly civil procedures? 972.11 contemplates that civil procedure would apply.
Yes. Well, that's true, but given that the 805, it's directing your attention to that statute first. If you think of it, if you're a practitioner and you're looking at that statute, how would you know then to go on and find the, in a criminal case, how would you know to go on and find that the 801 and the 805 would be applicable?
Well, wouldn't that be because the prior sentence says that the rules of civil procedure are applicable?
Yes, unless the section or context requires a different construction.
So then you would go to the civil procedure statutes. You'd find the provision on subpoenas, and you'd find out what it says there, wouldn't you?
Yes, but it just seems that there are these two separate ways for serving a subpoena. There's a more detailed process set forth in the civil, and then there's also a simpler process that, once again, it shall apply in criminal cases.
Wouldn't the greater detail make 805.07 the more specific statute?
Well, I think that the greater detail at least goes more towards the procedure. I don't think that it goes one way or another, and in fact, my next point is that I think the greater detail and the fact that it's so highly specific is a policy reason why you wouldn't want to apply these statutes in a criminal case. So some of the disadvantages that I see applying the 805, first of all, it is very highly fact-specific. I think that it could likely increase in litigation when you're talking, if a witness does not show up, there is going to be both parties, state and defense, are going to start arguing, looking at the facts and saying that we shouldn't get a continuance. So in that respect, I really could increase costs for that reason. One of the advantages
Has that been the experience on the civil side, do you think?
I cannot speak to the civil side and just know in criminal cases there are also different interests at stake when it comes to wanting witnesses to come to court.
I want to go back, if you are finished answering Justice Kelly's question, I want to go back to Justice Abrahamson's question about substituted service, because as I read 88503, I did not think it was substituted service. And, when you're in a criminal proceeding, if somebody doesn't show up, and they've been served, the court issues a body attachment. Now, in a civil proceeding, it's not the way you proceed if someone doesn't show up. Then you've got to bring on a motion, and someone has been properly served, and they've dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, and court will make a decision. But in criminal matters, it's very important to have the witnesses there. And I had not thought it was substituted service. It deals only with witnesses. It doesn't deal with the defendant. And if you look at some of the other provisions, it's to affect personal jurisdiction, and it deals with a party. So witness is not a party. And I don't know if you were finished answering her question when you got another question, but I want to talk a little bit more about, do you think that 88503 is substituted service? And if it is, why? And if it's not, why not?
Well, it doesn't use that term in there. There's no reference to the substitute service. I think that it just provides three examples of service, you know, leaving it at the house, exhibiting, or it says that you can personally give it to the witness. And so I would agree with that. I think what's difficult is the substitute service term. That comes up more in the 805 and the 801. It doesn't, you know, there's no reference to that in the 885. And as you were saying, I think one of the reasons we want witnesses to come to court in criminal cases, and that really supports why this 885 should apply in a criminal case. It's simple. It's clear. It provides more flexibility, so not every single witness, you don't have to go through all these steps to personally serve them, depending. I mean, there are certainly instances where a witness, you may want to try multiple attempts to personally serve, but there are cases where you might not want that. And so that would just be one of the reasons why the 885, from a policy perspective, could be would be more appropriate for a criminal case.
I'm done. I just wanted to address that. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, your focus is on 88503, and you say that's it. 972 that gets you to 88503, and that's it. You don't need the 805 or 7 or 801.11. But okay, so let's not deal with 805.07 and 801.11. Let's just look at 88503. Wouldn't it be better if there were substituted service written in there? You speak of policy reasons. And I can advance, I think, two strong policy reasons why we should write into 88503 a substituted service provision. Number one, due process concerns of the witness who's subject to contempt if they don't show. I understand, and that's why I asked, is due process involved here? And you said no, and it's not an issue. But I'm talking about policy reasons. Number two, it avoids a potential fight in the circuit court with the attorney saying, well, I had my assistant leave something at 512 Elm Street, and someone else saying, well, no one ever had received anything at 512 Elm Street. And so why don't we say, look, there's got to be an affidavit of service or a certificate of service, and there has to be, if not personal service, substituted service in the manner as set forth in 801.11. Why don't we write that in there?
Those are legitimate concerns. My response first, when you're talking about a body attachment, is just because a witness doesn't show up doesn't mean that the court needs to order a body attachment. That would be up to the court. The court could also grant a continuance to give the witness an opportunity to show up. The other response I have is just that even when people have noticed, that also does not necessarily mean that they are going to show up. So an example would be this particular case where the witness, she had notice and called and sent a letter and wasn't able to, it did not come to the court. And so then at that point it becomes a question, or it's up to the court, is a continuance appropriate? Is a body attachment appropriate? And so that depends, I think, a lot on the specific facts of the case. And in this case, it seems to me that the court should have granted a continuance.
Counsel, could I ask that you put a finer point on your answer to Justice Bradley's question, and in particular this. If I understand it correctly, you were saying that as a policy consideration, we should be especially concerned in criminal cases that witnesses attend. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And wouldn't it make it more likely that we could get a witness to attend if there was an attempt, reasonable diligence to personally serve, and then if you couldn't achieve personal service, that you would go through the procedure identified in 80111 in leaving the subpoena with someone who could then get it along to the actual witness? Wouldn't that further your policy consideration?
Yes, I think you're correct in that respect, and I just wanted to make clear, though, that by saying that 885 applies doesn't mean that you still, the state or this defense, still couldn't do that if they felt necessary in terms of getting, if there's somebody they know that's perhaps a difficult witness. There's nothing that prevents them from also using that additional, taking those additional steps. It's just that in some circumstances that might not necessarily be needed. And then second of all, just because people always have, you know, even if they have notice, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to come. And so if you, you know, it might be a more difficult call and might not be a correct exercise of discretion if there's no indication in the record that the witness did in fact have the notice. I mean, when you're making the decisions on the continuance and body attachment, whether or not they're properly subpoenaed, it's just a portion of the overall question or analysis when making the decision. And so I could see that it might not be a proper exercise of discretion if there's no indication or no facts on the record that the witness ever had received the subpoena, whereas contrasting to a case like this where she did and she just did not come.
Let's focus on that for just a moment, if we could. I understand that she had a letter brought to court indicating her inability to attend. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that part of the record?
The letter, to my knowledge, the record I received did not include it, and I did not see it in the trial attorney's file that I had received.
Do we know what it said?
I do not. And I would also note there was, in addition, according to the record, the attorney had actually made a phone call to her as well. And so that's where some of the information is just coming from, is what the attorney had presented.
Is there any factual dispute about whether the witness had actually received the subpoena and knew that she was to appear at that time and date in court to testify?
That was not something that was specifically contested in terms of or touched upon in the record, whether or not she had actually received it. We just know that she had notice about the hearing, and it seemed, at least from the record, that she must have known she had to be there because she called in and she sent a letter. And it just
seemed... How do you know that? Because the lawyer said that, right?
Yes. This is from
the transcript. The lawyer said he got the letter. She's got the letter, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that why there was no argument made about admission of service?
I apologize. Could you please repeat the question?
Sure. So I noticed in the briefing there was no discussion of admission of service, as frequently occurs in civil procedure, either to a summons and complaint or a subpoena. An attorney will admit service or a person will admit service, so you don't have to go through all the time and expense of the complicated methods and costly methods of service. So I was a little curious about why no one argued, well, she admitted service. She sent a letter to court. She was on a phone call acknowledging that she was supposed to be there but couldn't. Was the reason that argument was not made because the letter was not admitted into evidence and it was just the attorney reporting on the phone call with her?
I think that is possible. I am not that familiar when you're talking about the civil procedures. I just know that was not something that was disputed or fleshed out from a factual perspective. I think that could be another reason that this court, if it would so decide, would support a remand to perhaps get some of those additional facts into the record regarding that, if that would be something that needed to have been done.
Counsel, now that you're mentioning what you're seeking, if we do accept your statutory construction, I have a question for you about that. You are asking for an evidentiary hearing so that testimony can be taken from the witness who didn't show up. Is that right?
Yes.
One other option would be to look at defense counsel's failure to object to the court's ruling regarding the subpoena, and to look at this under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel. And one way we could do that is because the trial court judge here made some pretty extensive findings based on a proffer of what the witness would have testified to had she appeared in court. Is there enough in the record for the court to evaluate what her testimony would have been and whether it would have had an impact, thereby prejudicing your client by her absence?
I disagreed with that there's enough in terms of actually being able to conclude that her testimony did not matter. I think it's important that we have witnesses actually give testimony, so that gives the attorney or the trial court an opportunity to observe their demeanor and their appearance and how they respond to questions. And so that would also support another reason why in this particular case there should have either at the time they should have had a continuance to allow the testimony, or now that we should also want to send this back to have her testify and really give the opportunity to the trial court to decide whether or not he or she would find the witness credible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jason Gorn. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin, appearing for the state in this case. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision because reasonable diligence pursuant to 801.11.1b provides the workable standards by which circuit courts can judge and analyze valid subpoena process for witnesses in criminal cases. In this case, Wilson pursued substituted service, but he failed to follow the substituted service statute. And what that substituted statute requires is that he is first reasonably diligent in pursuing personal service, which the circuit court found as a finding of fact that he was not diligent.
Counsel, what is the purpose of the reasonable diligence provision of 801.11 sub 1 sub b?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow, Your Honor.
What is the purpose of the reasonable diligence requirement in section 801.11 sub 1 sub b?
Well, so it's important to understand first that 805 is a statute that comes from the Judicial Council. And the Judicial Council had serious concerns about the due process provided to witnesses. The Wisconsin Practice Series, it's volume 3A, I believe it's section 562 around there, speaks to the problem about due process and that we need to provide the best service first, because when a party provides service by leaving it at the abode, there was a lot of concern about the due process that would be provided.
Right. So isn't the let me just quote from your brief at page 21. So you say, consequently, if anything, the legislative history shows that the reasonable diligence requirement exists for the purpose of ensuring, as much as possible, that a witness receives actual notice before the subpoena's proponent can fall back on constructive notification.
That's correct.
Okay. Didn't the witness receive actual notification in this case?
So the problem here...
Did the witness receive actual notification of the subpoena?
From the record, it seems that she knows one thing, that there was a time and place that the hearing would happen. But
she knew she was supposed to testify at that
when she was supposed to testify. When you look at really the considerations about what a form subpoena is, there's several things that we need to impress upon a witness. One of those things is notice about the time and place. But if you even look at the subpoena that was served in this case, in bold letters, what it discusses is the ramifications and the repercussions about not testifying, which is you can go to jail. You will get arrested. You will be placed in jail. You will have to bail out. And the record's silent on that point. So when we're talking about constructive service, my first argument is still there's no bailout provision under 801.11.1b, but regardless, if we're going to talk about policy issues, it doesn't apply in this circumstance because there's serious considerations about notice for a witness that just doesn't work here. The problem is that Wilson is asking for a policy standpoint for easier service for criminal defendants, but in the end it works against criminal defendants. Because when you talk about subpoena service, you're talking about notice. This is not an inquiry about the subpoenaing party. It's about the recipient of the subpoena. And what you have here is when you have reduced notice, if that works for criminal defendants, then what you have is essentially people aren't showing up to court. Witnesses that matter for defendants will not appear because the service is easier. But Wilson might argue that what I have here is at least a body attachment. I can bring these people and haul them into court if their testimony matters and they just didn't get notice and didn't show up. But then you turn friendly witnesses into hostile witnesses. And as a policy standpoint, you're really shooting yourself in the foot. And maybe Wilson in this case benefits because the witness that didn't show up, well, it was the mother of his girlfriend, so maybe no harm, no foul, she'll let it pass. But most witnesses in this case, defendants, need witnesses that they don't know, and they need them to appear. And so as a policy matter, it really works against the standard for defendants.
Isn't it easier to get a body attachment if you just follow 88503?
Indeed it is. I mean, if this court finds that 88503 applies, it's so broad, anything can fall under that statute. But the problem is that 80507 expressly applies to 885. It says subpoena practice will be done by 885 except in the situation of substituted service.
Well, but you talk about 801.11.1b, and that speaks to defendants. And 1A speaks to the service of a summon. We're not talking about that here. So doesn't it bother you a little bit that we have a statute that is solely for witnesses in criminal trials that was used here, and you're relying on a statute that applies to defendants and for jurisdiction? Doesn't say a word about witnesses that I could see.
So my first argument and point on that is 972 applies civil statutes to criminal cases unless manifestly unworkable.
Well, okay. So, and my question to you is, why isn't it manifestly unworkable when you're applying a statute that speaks to defendants and service of summons, and that's not what we're doing here?
So I understand that point, but when we actually talk about 805.07, the Judicial Committee's notes in 1974 say this: it is designed to make the service provisions respecting summonses and subpoenas more nearly identical. So what we're looking at is essentially that was the purpose, relate these
but
two.
But that's the Judicial Council on which I sat for 4 years. That is not a court, and that is not the law. That's their comment.
So my third.
Before you leave that, under 972.11, you apply the civil evidence, rules of evidence and practice, but there's the exception clause, unless. But the sentence that deals with 885 doesn't have an unless provision. It just says 85 to 95 and 995, and then it has an exception for some of the civil practice provisions. 885 shall apply in all criminal proceedings.
Period.
So when you're going to apply the other provisions, then you have to get to the unless and you have to interpret it. But as to 885, there's no interpretation required. It applies. I looked at, because of the Judicial Council note, I looked at, I don't know if you're familiar with it, a Charles Clausen's, I think he was the reporter for the Judicial Council, but I forgot to look that up. He has a law review article in the Marquette Law Review regarding the new rules of civil procedure. And he talks about sub 5, and he talks about it in reference to Mullane versus Hanover Trust Company, which was a United States Supreme Court from decision in 1950, and it regards what kind of service has to be given to beneficiaries of the trust. What I couldn't quite figure out on a fast read, I may have to go back and do a slow read, was whether or not these were people that had to be notified because there was personal jurisdiction needed versus a subpoena. And the way I read Professor Clausen's article, although it's not totally clear, is, hey, there's a difference when you're summonsing somebody as a party versus the subpoena, but you have to be careful as to both. And he says that 885.03 preceded the revision, and it was never changed, and it was intended to continue on. I think so that, do you think that this is a due process issue? Because that's the way Mullane handles it, as a due process. Do you think it's contrary to due process if you don't personally serve with reasonable diligence?
I think that was the consideration of the Judicial Council, at least. Okay. But it's not in this case. Exactly, Your Honor. This isn't a constitutional challenge. That's the main thing, that this is a case of statutory interpretation.
Let's take Let's take a look at the statute, and because you kept on saying policy reasons, and of course when I hear that I say, but what do the words of the statute mean? And how have others interpreted the words of the statute? You also mentioned the Wisconsin practice series, and a lot has been said thus far about the Judicial Council, so I want to take a look at the Wisconsin practice series. The Wisconsin practice series that you were referring to, I think, is the Wisconsin civil procedure practice series with regard to 80501. But I have the Wisconsin practice series with regard to criminal procedure and practice. And the first volume, I think, of this came out in 1996. This is the first edition. This is the second edition that came out in 2008, but updated most recently in June of 2016. And it provides, with regard to the issue that we're dealing with, in 24:13, service of subpoena, it says, Wisconsin Statute 885.03 provides that any subpoena may be served by any person. Service is accomplished simply by exhibiting the subpoena and reading it to the witness, by handing the witness a copy of the subpoena or by leaving a copy of it at the witness's residence. There's a rebuttable presumption, this criminal procedure and practice book says. There is a rebuttable presumption that the return of the subpoena by a sheriff is evidence of its proper service. So why shouldn't we follow the Wisconsin practice series on criminal practice and procedure rather than be guided by the Wisconsin practice series on civil procedure?
I don't think that's necessarily the choice. When I got into policy arguments, that was really in response to what was raised already earlier in the oral argument. But my primary argument here is that I have statutory authority.
Okay,
sometimes
when you interpret a statute, you've got a couple of choices. We have a couple of choices here. We can go with 885.03. We can do your 805.07 with your bringing in 801.11. And arguments on both sides, right? Why shouldn't we give some weight, apparently, to the way the practice series has been interpreting how you serve a subpoena on a witness in criminal procedures for at least a couple of decades? Why shouldn't we give some weight to that? Should we just toss it out?
No, Your Honor. So I think the fundamental thing here is that these two statutes, 885.03 and 805.07, do different things in this case. 885.03,
my question is, So what weight, if any, should we give to the interpretation of the Wisconsin practice series as I just set forth?
What I'm saying is we can have service at someone's abode, but it happens pursuant to 80507. There's nothing that I can test within the provision that says you can serve it at the abode. I'm saying that there is a valid practice in how to do that under 801111B.
Okay. So you're saying in order to assure more complete service, you have to do it, if you're going to leave it at the abode, in substituted service, because that permits the court to have factors to look at to see if they actually were served correctly. Is that right?
Exactly. There is a strike zone for the circuit court to basically have. Okay. They can call the balls and strikes on valid subpoena service.
And that makes sense to me. But I'll tell you, the problem for me is twofold. Number one, the words of the statute, I don't think, support your argument. Number two, you talk about the Wisconsin Judicial Council because that was the generating authority, of course, for both our civil procedure and our criminal procedure. They involve both. And you look at our court's website, and in fact, our court's website indicates that the Wisconsin Judicial Council is studying 8503. And the minutes that are set forth on our court's website, and so I assume the minutes are accurate and susceptible to judicial notice since we put them out. Our court's website indicates that the Judicial Council has been studying this issue, and indeed they now are going to be at the point, I think, of drafting something that asks us to change 88503. So should we change it before they ask us? And to have a substituted service, incorporate the 80111 substituted service into 88503? That's what they're going to be asking us to do, according to their minutes in March and minutes in April and their minutes in September. So should we, let's be on top of things. We like to be ahead of the game. Should we do it before they ask us?
So it isn't in the record, but yes, the Judicial Council has been considering revising the statutes. But I think from the latest revision that I saw in speaking to this was that reasonable diligence was going to apply, I think, directly into 805.07. But I think under my argument here and applying the statutes is still 80507 clearly applies to 883. My argument isn't that 885 doesn't apply. It just serves a different purpose. That's the what a party can do. There's three ways you can serve something. But the rudder in this case is 80507, and that tells a party how you serve a subpoena, specifically in the context of substituted service. And that's why we go under the statutory argument, which we know in this case there was substituted service. All we have to look at is the subpoena. And in Wilson's appendix, I think it's 270, I'm forgetting the exact page number, he checks the box in the subpoena that says, I subserved Lakita Brown on such and such a date at such and such a time. She was the daughter of the witness, and she was of legal age to be served. And when you look under 801111B, when you get down past personal service, that's exactly what the statute says. We know Wilson would have successfully substituted service on Jacqueline Brown. The only problem was he didn't do the first step. He wasn't reasonably diligent in executing personal service. And the circuit court made a finding of fact and said, you weren't reasonably diligent. I mean, this was a case, when we look at it, there's serious concerns about what the process was. We have a suppression hearing that was continued 3 months because the defense attorney said, my investigator hasn't served Jacqueline Brown. I'm worried about the process that's going to happen here. They continued the hearing for another 3 months, and then what we get is, well, I managed to give her substituted service. It's kind of something. But we don't know about her rights. Did she know that she had to appear or she could end up in jail? And counsel didn't want to even ask for the body attachment. He says, I think we can just have a continuance, just reissue the subpoena. But in the end, he basically forfeited the issue about arguing under 885. And that goes into a point that I think was raised earlier, is that this case is definitively in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. And the record demonstrates that in this case.
Before you get to that, one further inquiry about the statutory interpretation. I find that in the Court of Appeals opinion in a footnote, and that is footnote 2. The Court of Appeals indicates that there is an inherent, I quote, there is perhaps an inherent conflict in 805.075 and 885.3 because of the one imposing, quote, and imposing the stricter Wisconsin statute 801.11. But it's your position there's no conflict. Is that correct?
I disagree with that proposition. There is no conflict. We're not splicing the cable here in terms of what substituted service is. There's one form of substituted service. It comes under 801.11.1b, and that's it. I'm kind of wary at this point to go back into the Wisconsin practice series at this point, but what we have is a statement here that says 805.075 corrects the possible constitutional inadequacy of the provision of leaving it at the abode for substituted service of subpoenas.
So why didn't they correct it in 885.03? The history, the legislative history indicates 885.03 has been around since the late 1800s.
It has.
In essentially the same form. It was most recently modified in 1993, well after the rules of civil procedure were enacted in 1976. And yet, it didn't change 885.03 when it had the opportunity for doing that since 76, and a more recent opportunity when it actually did amend it in 93. Why didn't it add that?
Because we have different decision makers in this case. 805 was done by the Judicial Council and approved by this court. 885 was done by the legislature, and 885 has a lot to deal with. It's a general subpoena statute, and it talks more than just about the judicial setting. It's talking about administrative hearing, arbitrators. We have a lot of different concepts thrown around in 885.01, which broadens its applicability. But when we're looking at 805, I think the Judicial Council says, look, this is what we can do. We can just say one time, 805.07 expressly applies to 885, and that's what it says, and that's what we go off of. Is
that
express up?
Ineffective assistance of counsel. Was counsel ineffective for not learning more about what had been attempted and getting someone to testify about what had been attempted in regard to service? We don't know if the process server did more than leaving it at the usual abode, because we didn't have the process server there. So was counsel ineffective for not building a record to show the court that there were efforts made to serve if other efforts were made here?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
That basically goes into, again, constructive service, which that would be a bailout provision that doesn't fall under 801, is what I'm saying. Counsel did attempt to try and read the letter to the court, but the circuit court's position was, I don't need to hear that because you never validly served her in the first place.
No, but you're in a different place than I am.
I'm sorry.
I'm wondering if counsel was ineffective for not bringing the process server in. He had what the process server signed, which, as you point out, was substituted service. But we don't know if the process server ever tried to do anything else because he never came to court. Was that ineffective for counsel not to bring him to court?
I think all the circuit court had to do was look at the subpoena itself. We didn't have to have live testimony on that point.
Well, what if the process server had said, I tried to serve her at her place of work. I thought I could get her there, and I didn't get her there. I missed her, and so I ended up leaving it at her house.
That would conflict with the subpoena itself, which never listed any attempts that were previously made.
So if it doesn't list it, it never happened?
I think that's the subpoena. That's what we're going off of for a body attachment. That's really what activates the court's jurisdiction to initiate a body attachment, contempt proceedings, and so forth.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, for ineffective assistance of counsel, since I know you want to get there, I'm going to also assist you in that endeavor. On page 25 of your brief, I'm going to just note, the state does not dispute that the failure to properly serve, for purposes of this appeal, the state does not dispute that the failure to properly serve the subpoena on Jacqueline Brown amounted to deficient performance under Strickland. Is that your position?
Today, my position is a little bit different. I think I need to rescind essentially my deficient performance arguments, just I think for two reasons. One, after speaking with colleagues that are definitely more experienced than I am, it appears that there is an argument for deficient performance. I think initially my response and out of strategy is the statute clearly applies. I can't argue on the back end of deficient performance that there is no conflict, that there's no deficient performance because the law is uncertain. An attorney would not know what to do at the time that he tried to effectuate service. But I think that the very discussion that we're having about straight application of 805 versus straight application of 885.03 brings us back to the same position, which is we're arguing about something that was uncertain at the time that the attorney attempted to establish service on this witness.
What makes it uncertain when it's been in the Wisconsin practice series for criminal practice and procedure for a couple of decades? What makes it uncertain?
Again, it goes back to my statutory arguments. I think the language makes it clear, but there is an issue. There's no case that decided whether 805.07 is manifestly unworkable under 972. That's a consideration to make. Obviously, I say there is no manifest unworkability issue with 805.07.
Well, one doctrine of interpretation is that the statutes are designed to be read by many people: process servers, prosecutors, defense counsel, paralegals, banks, right? And you ought to give it, in the statutes, an interpretation that an ordinary, well-educated reader would take. Because what you don't want is somebody to have to read the statutes and read the case law and regulations and everything else that goes with it. Because that's not the design of statutes. Do you agree with that generally?
Yeah. Yes.
So it seems to me that the simplest and easiest reading of this statute is that 885.03 governs, because that's what the statute says about criminal statutes. 885 applies, period. Unlike the first part about 801 through 8, whatever it is, 11, only with a construction. So isn't that the simplest way to read this statute?
Again, it comes to the different purposes of the statute.
That may be, but then we have to go outside the text and start really digging, right?
With the express application, it's important to see that really this is a daisy chain argument where all of the statutes are linked together by express cross-references. And that's what the Court of Appeals found, that we don't just stop with 885 because we have 805 from a different body, essentially this court adopting that says we want 805.07 to apply to 885. And it doesn't say that 885 doesn't exist anymore. It says subpoena process will be done pursuant to 885.03, except when you start to get into substituted service by leaving the subpoena at the abode. Here's your framework.
I can't resist. What does subsection 2 mean after you get to the abode and leaving it with a person, and then it says substituted service in the law? Give me an example.
Okay. Are we talking about 801.11?
We're talking about, let's see. It's 801.11. It's 801.11.
Okay.
Yes, it's on page 3, and I want to commend Mr. Wren for putting all the statutes up front and very easy to read and find.
But going back to your original question,
yeah, I want to know what was subsection 2. Pursuant to the law for the substituted service of summons or light process on defendants in actions, what does that cover? Give me a for instance.
So it's B2 you're looking at, correct?
Yes.
That's the provision he's relying on that requires reasonable diligence, right?
I'm talking about little b. Are you looking at 2? I'm reading the wrong statute here.
Look at page 3 of your briefs, right? First you got A, by personally serving, 801.11.1a, and then you got 801.11.1b, if with reasonable diligence. This is the statute you're relying on.
Yes.
The defendant can't be served under A, which is a personal service. Then you leave it at the defendant's usual place of abode, 1, in the presence of a competent member, 2, 1M, in the presence of a competent adult currently residing. So it's family member, adult, and then 2, which is on line with the first 2. So you're going to leave at the defendant's usual place of abode pursuant to the law for the substituted service of summons. How you read it. Give me an example.
That would be out of state service. Mm-hmm. That's what it goes to.
Okay.
And that's another additional factor that makes this statute more specific than the general context of 885. I have limited time here, but there's one more thing that I want to raise. We did talk about deficient performance, but I want to talk about ineffective assistance in terms of prejudice. Essentially, the end of the day inquiry here is there is no prejudice because what Wilson talks about doesn't go to the exact independent credibility finding of the circuit court in this case. The circuit court talked about one thing. And the reason why Wilson lost in this case is because we have 2 witnesses sitting next to each other that observed the exact same thing at the exact same time, but testified differently. And the circuit court's problem with that wasn't the fact that Wilson testified, I saw 3 guns, and then Robert said, I saw 2 guns. The fact was the initial discrepancy between the 2 victims, or between the 2 witnesses.
But what if the witness who didn't testify would have corroborated one of those other 2, all of whom had arguably different vantage points?
Right. So what we have here is essentially it was the initial conflict. And it doesn't, even if Wilson would argue and say, I saw 3 guns, that bolsters this one inconsistent statement. The court's worried about the other inconsistent statement from Roberts because we have the 2 people that the court can't square up and reconcile. If Brown in this case could reconcile what Wilson and Roberts saw in that car, that would confront the credibility determination from the circuit court. But it doesn't. She can testify until she's blue in the face about seeing 3 guns and bolster Wilson's testimony, but at the end of the day, she does nothing to reconcile the actual conflict, which is what Robert saw in the car. And because of that conflict, there is no prejudice because her testimony essentially doesn't matter. It doesn't have a reasonable likelihood of a different result.
But that was the key issue, wasn't it? According to the circuit court, and I quote, as a practical matter, if they came to the vehicle with guns ablaze, then we have a different issue because then the people in the car could have felt they were under arrest or didn't have a choice other than to be searched. So it's a key issue. It would seem to me it's the only key issue of all of the testimony I've heard today.
Right. And that's true. I mean, the question overall is, I'm sorry, I see that my red light is...
You can finish answering the question, please.
The problem is credibility. It's not the fact that are there guns or no guns. It's the fact that we have 2 witnesses that say that guns were pointed at them, but they're saying different things. And it's the credibility determination that the circuit court found that would be unaffected by Brown's testimony because this wasn't a jury trial. The circuit court knew about the existence of Brown's testimony, analyzed it in his analysis, and said it wouldn't matter in this case, and that deserves deference. I'd like to thank this court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
see this case, and really there's two issues in this case. One, there's the really technical portion of this.
Excuse me, would you stop just a minute? It's too high for you, and very good.
Thank you
so much. No, it's not your apology that's needed. Please, thank you.
So the way I see this case is there are really two issues. There's the technical aspect of this, what subpoena statute applies, and then there's the bigger picture of this is what should have happened. And so I would ask that this court remand for a hearing. I think in this particular case, the witness had notice. She was a necessary and key witness. And overall, we want trial courts to be resolving these disputes. We want defendants to have an opportunity to bring in the witnesses, present their case, and have the court judge based on their appearance, their demeanor, and the way that they respond to questions. And so for that reason, I would ask that this court simply remand this case for an evidentiary hearing.
And what's the point of the evidentiary hearing?
There's two options. The court could find that the circuit court erred either in concluding that the subpoena was improperly done, or the court, I believe, could also find that the continuance should have been granted or there should have been a body attachment issued. Or the other option would be have a hearing, have Ms. Brown testify, and then also have an ineffective assistance of counsel hearing to ask if there was any reasonable strategy, which here I don't believe that, if something didn't happen right. And for that reason, either the person was not properly subpoenaed or the witness was properly subpoenaed and the circuit court made a mistake.
Counsel, before becoming a judge, my background was more in civil practice and civil procedure, and I loved civil procedure then. And quite frankly, when I looked at 885.03, I said to myself, are you kidding? Leave it at the place of abode? I mean, what kind of operation is that? Your opposing counsel speaks of workability, practicality. I held up, like Kerry A. Nation, I held up this Wisconsin practice series. But he correctly says, it's not the law. And he argues, I think, effectively, that it's got to be more workable than what you look at 885.03.
885.03, though, is flexible. I mean, it doesn't just necessarily mean that you're leaving it at the abode. An attorney could or investigator could follow up via phone and confirm that the witness had, in fact, received the subpoena. Likewise, could also do email. It's just less technical, whereas under the other statute, the reasonable diligence statute, that might not satisfy if they had left it at the abode and then the person followed up via email or phone call to confirm whether or not the notice had received. So that would be one of the advantages of the 885, was just the flexibility. And once again, too, that doesn't mean that attorneys should just necessarily leave it. It depends on the circumstance and the witness and the person that you're looking to have come into court. There are certainly instances that even though that statute says you can leave it there, that may not be something that you'd want to do, in which case you'd want to make additional efforts. And so that's one of the advantages that I see to the 885. The second advantage would be that it is simple. It's clear. We're not going to be entering into these huge hyper-technical arguments about whether or not there's reasonable diligence in the criminal cases. And so for that reason, I would 885 is appropriate in criminal cases, both because of the language of the statute and then also that it is consistent with the nature of a criminal case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very good arguments. Your briefs were also very good, which is a big help to the court when we have good briefs to help us with a sticky issue like the one we have here. We are going to take a brief adjournment. We have a class, I think I can see outside, that's going to be joining us, and so we will adjourn for the second case until our marshal tells us we're ready to go.